The Power of the Dog is, full disclosure right here at the top, my favorite film of the year so far. It's the latest from writer-director Jane Campion and stars Benedict Cumberbatch, Jesse Plemons, and Kirsten Dunst. It's the tale of a pair of brothers who run a cattle ranch in Montana in the 1920s. When one brother marries and brings his new bride and her teenage son back to live with him at the ranch, the other brother gets jealous and sets out to destroy their happiness. It's all set against the stark and at times overpowering beauty of the natural world, and it's bound to be a big contender come Oscar time. I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about The Power of the Dog on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining us today is NPR Culture Desk correspondent Neda Ulubi. Welcome back, Neda.
Hi, thank you.
And also joining us from his home in Denver is writer and film critic Walter Chow. Hey, Walter.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here.
And rounding out the panel from her home in New York is film critic and culture journalist Badatri D. Chaudhry. Hey, Badatri.
Thank you so much. So happy to be back.
Let's get into this. The Power of the Dog is based on a 1967 novel by Thomas Savage, the aptly named Thomas Savage. It stars Jesse Plemons as George and Benedict Cumberbatch as Phil, two brothers who run a cattle ranch. George keeps the books while the more charismatic Phil does the work. George marries a widow named Rose, played by Kirsten Dunst. She's got a teenage kid named Peter. He's a shy, smart kid who likes making paper flowers and hopes to study medicine. He's played by Cody Smith McPhee. Phil's jealousy and seething malice begins to take their toll on everyone around him. It's a tough, uncompromising film about many things, including where our notions of masculinity come from, what happens when they're allowed to fester, and how strength can be measured in many different ways. The Power of the Dog is writer-director Jane Campion's first film in 12 years. She shot it in her native New Zealand, doubling from Montana, and it's just a gorgeous film to look at. It's in theaters now. It's also streaming on Netflix. Badatri, what'd you make of The Power of the Dog?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's definitely one of my favorites this year so far. And, you know, I'm a big Jane Campion fan. So, you know, this is something we've all been waiting for and 12 years in the waiting. And I think this lives up to that wait. And I really appreciate what she does with the very masculine genre of Western films. It's so much like Western films as we know it. It's so much about the outdoors and the expanses, which is here and beautifully filmed, like you said. But I really appreciated the delving that she does into the interiors of like what happens inside the home of the quote-unquote rugged cowboy. Yeah, so that is something I really appreciated. And I think that that's what she brings to the genre. And I mean, I wouldn't think she would have made a Western, but then, hey, she is all about surprises.
That's true. That's true. And she is returning to some of her themes that she's worked with before in films like The Piano. Neda, what'd you think?
Well, Glenn, you know how I never like the movies that everyone else does.
And
maybe it would help with this one and with certain other very wildly popular movies that we've discussed in the past. It would help me if they weren't so hyped. I feel like if I'd gone into this one with lowered expectations, I would have loved it more. Mm-hmm. It left me lukewarm, not cold, but lukewarm. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's ravishingly beautiful, to steal actually a line from Walter. It is one of the most beautiful movies I've had the pleasure to watch in years. It reminded me in many ways of The Piano more than it did of a Western, where instead of the ocean, we had the desert. We had a single mom with a vulnerable child. We have a character who is connecting with the landscape in this really kind of deep and profound way. That would not be a man. And there is a piano, by the way, that serves a lot of symbolic purposes.
That's true. That's true. I love it when we don't agree. So, Walter, where do you come down?
When I first saw this, you know, this was my favorite movie of the year until I saw Drive My Car, the Hamaguchi movie that just came out. But, you know, it's a neck and neck sort of thing. I adore Jane Campion. I think she is our poet laureate, you know, of the film world. Her movies are in love, in rapture with language and the word. And her characters are these outsiders that long to be insiders. They're sort of like Billy Wilder characters, protagonists in a way, but they are exceptional outsiders. They're exceptional aliens in some way. And so I think I've always connected with Jane Campion as an Asian American in the United States. There's things that are celebrated about Asian Americans in the United States that sort of make us foreign and make us outside. And Campion seems to have an unusual empathy for that. And, you know, it reminded me of The Piano. Yes, absolutely. You know, it reminded me most of all of Sweetie, her first film.
Absolutely.
From 1989. Yeah. You know, another story about siblings that are sort of bound together. And one is monstrous and the other is normal, quote unquote, whatever that means.
Yep.
And I love how Power of the Dog is really an interrogation of all of these things, but also particularly of gender roles and things that are, you know, traditionally thought to be masculine and traditionally thought to be feminine, and how those are straitjacketing these characters in certain ideas, and how the child played by Cody Smith McPhee, more of a young man than a child, is transgressive of all of those stereotypes and the subject of scorn and perhaps danger and threat, and at the end is revealed to be stronger than we first think. And so, you know, in the very beginning, the Peter character, the young man, makes flowers out of paper, and they're actually pages of a book, and he keeps a photo album. And the photo album, the pictures that they look at in the photo album, actually predict the future for the mother. There's a mansion in the middle of a plane, and there's a wedding dress. And so there's some kind of terrible poetic design in this film, like a Baudelaire poem or H.P. Lovecraft even. Mm-hmm. There's doom coming. And the sort of rapture with words is ravishing. It is unbelievably beautiful. It reminded me of In the Cut as well,
yeah,
in that sense. I loved it.
It's so heavy. The film sits so heavy on the audience. And even with the long shots, it's just so claustrophobic. Mm-hmm. What is true of most of Campion's work is, like, there's always that foreboding fear of violence, even if you know it's coming, it's always coming. That's something obviously she's a master of, and she does very well with this film as well.
The violence when it comes is not sensationalized.
Yeah.
It's flat and it's ugly. There are a couple of scenes, I think, in this film that are difficult to watch, just like, you know, every film, like The Piano. There's no romance to that, and I really admire that.
Yes. The reason I love this film as much as I did is, for me at least, it had two effects. One, as I'm watching it, we talked about how you let it wash over you. It's so gorgeous. There's another effect that happens once you start thinking about it after it's over, because this film could be taught in schools about the difference between story and plot. Story being what things happen, plot being why they happen. So if you were to make a big mistake and go and read the synopsis of this film on Wikipedia, you'd get the story as I got it, because you're watching a film and you're seeing a sequence of events arranged by chronology. One thing happens after another. But if you just read the story, you know, on Wikipedia, you might think that some of the depictions of toxic masculinity in this film, that there's a didactic quality to them. This is something the Campion's been accused of before. And that the film sees itself as somehow more enlightened, more aware than its characters, and it's trying to score rhetorical or even political points. But I really think that the execution, these characters aren't the broad types that they start off on. They are all given room to breathe and deepen. And that's the fun of this film. This is one of those rare films that when you look back on it, you can see that what seemed to be a sequence of events, as you mentioned, Walter, is in fact part of a design. Suddenly things you kind of merely noted happening, now you see they were all there for a reason. A character exchanges looks with this other character that you interpret one way in the moment, and then you realize it meant something else, very different. There is a pure joy in that. And that's why I think this film helps to straddle the art house and the cinemaplex. You know, it's gorgeous. It's meditative. It's got this kind of, you know, airy aesthetic quality. It's about things like capital M masculinity. But there is a sly, pulpy quality to it that gets it out of pure aesthetic pleasure to a kind of viscerally satisfying story for me.
You know, Glenn, I wouldn't disagree with you about any of this. And at the same time, I found the script plotting. People literally say things like, I have a surprise for you. What is it? If I told you, it wouldn't be a surprise.
Fair point, fair point. Can we talk about the performances? When I heard that Cumberbatch was going to be doing a Western accent, I had brown acid flashbacks to August Osage County, where I think it's safe to say he kind of face planted in that thing. But he's getting a lot of Oscar talk, so why do you think that is?
I think he's getting a lot of that talk because of the quote-unquote courage of his performance. I feel like maybe that's probably why. I never really got over his accent, I have to admit. I wasn't convinced necessarily, but I did like, you know, what Netta didn't like. And she's right. It's very staid and very formal in the speech. It feels artificial. I like that in a way for this film because it feels like they're in a potpourri jar. It's suffocating, it's heavy, it's doom-laden, and they're all kind of speaking through their lower bellies. You know, they can barely seem to get any kind of emotion out. You know, and that's what proves to be fatal, ultimately. And the very last shots of the film, I don't want to give it away, show a different kind of more human interaction between the characters that we like in this movie, things that we hadn't seen except for the very beginnings of their courtship, begin to bloom again with the resolution of the central plot.
I'm just going to leap in very quickly to my own defense. Like, all of those things, Walter, that you talk about, like, I loved those things in The Lost Daughter. They didn't work for me here. With this one, I just didn't quite buy what everyone was selling.
And that includes Cumberbatch.
Who just for me did not strike me as menacing. The enigmaticness that he brings to his roles kind of began and ended. I didn't feel much glimmer of an inner life. The scariest things he did really was like he slaps around a horse, he plays the banjo. That's kind of, and he and he glowers. I found myself trying to be afraid of him and failing.
I think the buzz is there because he's an unlikely choice. You know, I don't think this is his role of a lifetime. And I agree with Walter. And I mean, I enjoyed it, but I don't think I could ever forget who I was watching. And just the fact that he's doing what I don't assume he would do, I think that just took over me just looking at him play this character.
For me, Cumberbatch really nails this character early, and he completely sold me on it. It's the scene in the restaurant when Cumberbatch and his men, his fellow cowherds, are crowding into the restaurant. And this is a long shot. It's from high up, and the whole scene is filled with movement, and as they're all kind of settling into the table, and Peter, the widow's son, who we talked about, Cody Smith McPhee, comes out of the kitchen, and you watch Cumberbatch in this scene. And listeners, if you haven't seen it yet, when this happens, watch Cumberbatch. He is like a Jedi. He senses something, starts looking around, and then he sees the kid, and his whole physicality changes. He kind of coils himself to strike.
I wonder what little lady made these.
Actually, I did, sir. My mother was a florist, so I made them to look like the ones in our garden.
Oh, well, do pardon me.
It's a malice that is rooted in a deep sense of recognition. And that's what the whole film's about. And in scenes when he's alone, he is fundamentally different than he is when he's around others, especially his men, which, of course, is also what the whole damn movie's about. There's a rawness and a vulnerability in those scenes that I think it explains him. It doesn't excuse him. Or maybe it's an attempt to excuse him. I don't think it is. How do you guys think the setting of this film plays into it? This is a time frame. We're in the mid-20s here, so the Old West is dead. The New West is trying to find itself and establish itself. And it is this gorgeous, arid countryside. How does the setting impact how the film played on you?
Well, I love the Western because they usually occur in the period after the Civil War and before the rest of the country is completely industrialized by the proliferation of the rail. And, you know, so many of these classic Westerns, Shenandoah, Red River, they're about, you know, driving cattle to Chicago, driving, you know, to a railroad hub, essentially. And this death of a way of life, essentially, as industrialization begins to creep across the landscape. But, you know, with this film, you feel the sense of absolute melancholy that the certain traditions of the old man and the old woman, how would they refer to as their parents in this movie, are dying.
And we see it in George's character, how he is trying to become the face of the New West. Mm-hmm. In that restaurant scene that you just talked about, Glenn, you know, they're talking about something and he has no idea what the cowherd and his brother are talking about. And he literally says that, I don't know what you're talking about. So, you know, you see him coming out of those tropes of toxic masculinity, and he has like taste for the quote unquote finer things in life. He likes his cocktails with a little umbrella on it. Or, you know, he wants his wife to play the piano. So, you know, you kind of see that liminality and that transitory phase in American culture come out through him. And the weird thing is, like, Benedict Cumberbatch's character goes to Yale and is an Ivy League. I think he studied the classics, and you wouldn't know. It's just one of those things that if someone didn't drop it on the script, there's like no way of knowing. So he is that character, you know, if you look at the metaphor of it, that he's just like trying his very best to hold on to that old way of the West.
Yeah, there's a certain exceptionalism about Phil that you mentioned. You know, he's renowned for his intellect. He's all these things. It's even more so in the book. And he tries to pass as one of the boys. And I think passing is a lot of what this film is about, you know, trying to hide all of the feminine aspects. Yes, I've read, you know, Plato and Ovid, but I can castrate this calf with my bare hands.
And I stink and I love it.
Yes, I stink and I love it. And yet, you know, he kind of leans into being the outside. But I love that we are introduced to George in a bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
Phil is striding across the open plain. You see him through these windows and this little box that he's put himself in. And George is just like, you ever try the bathtub, Phil?
Yep.
It's pretty nice. And so, you know, these roles that they're trying to break out of that George is not even aware of, I think he's too simple, is ultimately, I think, what attracted me to this film.
Well, that's it, right? Because, I mean, it's the perfect temporal setting because one brother is clinging to the past, one aspect of the past, and the other is grasping for the future. It's only in this time when that they could kind of meet in the middle there. Last thing I want to ask about is Dunst's character, Rose. Does she get short shrift in this movie? Because I'm undecided on this point. I haven't made up my mind yet. She's clearly victimized by Phil, but does the film treat her as a victim and nothing more? Netta, what do you think?
I thought her performance was unbelievable. I thought in some ways the movie belonged to her. I was blown away by her power, by what she brought to this character. As you were all talking and making these wonderful points, it occurred to me that she embodies the tension of all of these things the most. You know, her relationship with the land, the way she's sort of struggling in between a connection to the New West and the old. On the one hand, she's a woman who played the piano to support herself at a movie theater. On the other hand, now she's getting forced to play the piano to entertain her husband's guests. She loses herself in all kinds of ways. She tries in this kind of embarrassing, cringy way to make connections with the Native Americans who she meets. She tries and she fails, and she succeeds in protecting her son. One of the things that I find really interesting about her character, I just have to say really quickly, is both Phil and George derive, you know, of course, their power from their class. Phil can kind of afford to go on and on about how much he stinks because he can afford to. He owns half the place, you know? Mm-hmm. Rose is very hamstrung by class in a way that I found a little bit confusing, especially vis-a-vis her son. The teenage boy doesn't seem to be affected by class in the same way that his mother is. Her dependence on her husband's money is something that completely defines her character in a way that it doesn't seem to define her son whatsoever. Sometimes I wondered if he had his own independent source of income. So Dunst herself was wonderful. Her lack of chemistry, though, I felt, with the guy who is her husband in real life, was either an acting feat or just one of the mysteries for the ages.
If you remember, there's that scene right after they get married where they're like on this hilltop and drinking tea out of a picnic basket. And George's character, and which is, I think, one of my favorite moments in the film, is when he says, it's just so nice to not be alone. And that, for me, is what a lot of the film is about companionship or not finding yourself a companion and like what it does to you. Maybe it's just a decision she made, or both of them made, to just not be alone anymore. For me, her character is like emblematic of that want to be with somebody else and not be solitary anymore. And she kind of brings George out of that very masculine trope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love that scene that you mentioned. It's in the book as well, but it isn't there. You know, the line is there, but there's not the scene where they stop. He's sort of talking about, you know, wanting to learn how to dance, but in the film they actually show it. And I think, you know, it's really a masterpiece in many ways of adaptation when you read the book and you see the things that Jane Campion is choosing to prioritize, the things that she adds in the film to make it more visual. I find to be fascinating. That idea of a design, the sort of wonderful flowers of evil feeling I got from it is like, that's my worldview, I hate to say, a little bit. I feel like Campion produced a film for me this year anyway that speaks to how I'm feeling. And she seems to talk to me whenever, you know, In the Cut spoke to me exactly the way I wanted to be spoken to in 2003. I can't watch 5 minutes of Bright Star without crying my eyes out. You know, she speaks to me in a very kind of essential way. And I'm willing to overlook a lot of the very fine points that Netta has made about, you know, how this movie is displacing and maybe even off-putting. And I just have a relationship in my heart with her that makes me forgive it, where I maybe wouldn't have forgive it as easily in other films.
Well, that is one of many reasons why I think this is not going to be the last time we talk about the film The Power of the Dog. I think we're going to be talking about it again come Oscar time, with all the caveats that Oscars are and Oscars do what Oscar's going to do. We want to know what you think about The Power of the Dog. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at PCHH. Up next, what's making us happy this week?
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With Early Paycheck, you can get your direct deposit up to 2 days earlier. And with no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision. Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank. Capital One N.A. Member FDIC.
And now it's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Netta, let's start with you. What is making you happy this week?
Well, it's another podcast. I'm so sorry. I feel that's really gauche.
Totally fine.
But I was absolutely riveted by Once Upon a Time at Bennington College. I can't remember the last time I really, really, really binged a series podcast. It takes you into all of the salacious gossip involving Bret Easton Ellis and Donna Tartt and Jonathan Lethem when they were all undergraduates together at Bennington, and traces who they became, this phenomenon known as the literary Brat Pack back in the 1980s. I am totally showing my age. This is a podcast that was built in a lab for Gen Xers like me. It's delicious. It's gossipy. It was so much fun. And it's called Once Upon a Time in Bennington College.
Thank you very much, Netta Ulaby. Badatri, what is making you happy this week?
This is a little bit of a happy, sad, bittersweet situation because, you know, we've all been kind of mourning Sondheim's death, but also celebrating his absolute, magical, fantastic legacy. So, you know, what's been making me really happy is just being on Twitter, reading what people have to say about him. And like, one of them is, I think last Sunday, Broadway performers took to the main area in Times Square and sang Sunday from Sunday in the Park with George. And that video, I cannot tell you how many times I've just like cried watching that video. And yeah, so just look around and you on Twitter, you'll find it.
Well, that's a great pick. Thank you, Badatri. Walter, what is making you happy this week?
What's really making me happy is this Netflix series called City of Ghosts. It's an animated series. There's only 6 episodes. It's created by a woman named Elizabeth Ito. And it's essentially just 4 kids, Zelda, Thomas, Eva, and Peter. And they go around Los Angeles interviewing ghosts about why they're still hanging around. And through it, you learn about the Filipina chef on the corner, or the Japanese chef, or the small business owner in Koreatown. And it's so gentle and empathetic that it serves as a really nice palate cleanser from the news or even the movies that are dark, like Power of the Dog. There's something to be said about 18 to 20 minutes per episode, 6 episodes, just really kind of resetting your mood. It's the kind of thing that I wish that I had when I was a kid. City of Ghosts, you know, kind of hidden in the kids section on Netflix. I really couldn't recommend it more.
Fantastic. City of Ghosts on Netflix. What's making me happy this week is 80s News Screens. That is a Twitter account where the truth is in the advertising. And if you take my advice and you follow 80s News Screens on Twitter, you'll be doom scrolling, and then boom, a still from an 80s local newscast will appear in your feed with just the cheesiest graphics, the worst hair, the shoulder pads, the makeup, the raw sincerity in these chyrons along the bottom of the screen. They kind of burn your retinas because they kind of sizzle. And that's not just the color contrast, but like the fonts, to say nothing of the fonts, guys. So many stiffly coiffed, moosed to the gods news anchors are staring down the barrel of the camera, while behind them, there's a graphic that's like dangerous chicken or turkey tips. Or you get person on the street interviews, you know, that have these identifiers of people like Maureen Davis, stranded honeymooner, or Eric Nelken bought pizza. Now, I don't want to oversell this, but can I just say it helps? Now, local news is always going to local news. But just in terms of design, measurable improvement, improvement you can see, aesthetic improvement. Now, you can have nostalgia at the same time for these really try-hard crudeness of these 80s graphics, but oh my God, how far we've come. It matters, it helps, it's necessary. It's 80s News Screens on Twitter. Check it out. And that is what is making me happy this week. If you want links for what we recommended, plus some more recommendations, subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at G.H. Weldon. You can follow Netta at UlaBeast. You can follow Badatri at Badatri. And you can follow Walter at Mangiato. You can follow editor Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, producers Candace Lim at TheCandaceLim, and Ramel Wood at Blurgosphere. And you can follow producer Mike Katziff, as always, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In provides the music that you may or may not be bobbing your head to right now. Your life, your rules. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much. I really enjoyed all of your insights. You made me see the movie differently. Thanks.
And thanks to you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. We will see you all next week.